Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations on the exchange, you're welcome to do that as well. Phone numbers are 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. The demonstrations in New York in the fall of 2011 certainly built, both in size and in attention from the public. Occupy Wall Street, the movement was called, even though it did not technically do what its name implied. OWS dominated headlines for weeks, even though news people, if not the broader public, seemed to have difficulty understanding its aims. For one thing, it did not have a singular public face or focus. Other than "We are the 99%, the Occupy movement did not work in bumper sticker slogans. Today's guest was in the delivery room for the birth. Nathan Schneider wrote the book Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Nathan Schneider wrote about Occupy Wall Street for Harper's, The Nation, The New York Times, and other publications. He edits the websites Waging Nonviolence and Killing the Buddha. His other book is God in Proof. Nathan Schneider, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
In the foreword to your book provided by Rebecca Solnit, she writes that people find themselves members of a we that did not exist. So the idea of "We are the 99%, for example, was that, did it feel like a spontaneous sort of combustion to you?
Actually, it was striking how much it was in the air at that moment. You know, at the time in the summer of 2011, I was in the process of covering several simultaneous efforts to launch something kind of like a Tahrir Square in the United States. And this idea of the 99% kept coming up in different ways. Like, actually, in the summer earlier, in June, there was an effort by the group Anonymous to occupy the same place that ended up becoming the occupation of for OWS, Zuccotti Park in the financial district, and their group was called A99. I think there was this growing recognition that that lines were being drawn in this country and in our economic systems and policies.
So when you say something like a Tahrir Square, was it as much about the content of what was being discussed as just the need that was felt for people to really express themselves?
Well, I think it was more, I would think about it in terms of inspiration. You know, I mean, the financial crisis had happened in 2007, 2008. People had been hurting for a few years, but there hadn't really been, you know, especially more on the left side of the political spectrum of our country, there hadn't really been an uprising in response to it. People had just felt like they had to take it. And I think that what happened in the Arab Spring, and then I think particularly what happened in Madison and then in Spain and Greece, inspired a lot of people in the U.S. into thinking that maybe they could do something too, and maybe there was a global movement taking place that they could join. You know, and so I think it goes beyond just, you know, a kind of copycat thing. It was they felt inspired. They felt like they had there was a sense of possibility for doing something.
Yeah, I must admit there are times in the last several years when you hear people say, "What does it take to get Americans into the streets?" So I bet there was some of that running through your head when this was all going on.
Oh yeah, you know, and just a few months earlier, I remember there was an op-ed in the Washington Post that asked just that question: "Why aren't Americans in the streets?" And at the time when that came out, I was covering all of these different attempts to get Americans into the streets, and it was just kind of striking that this was in a lot of people's heads at that moment. And it's a reminder, I think, that upheavals often come not just because of economic conditions, social conditions, not just out of frustration, but out of inspiration.
You write about, the book is organized chronologically, I should point out, begins in August 2011, and there's a street meeting that you write about where the people said right up front, "No pictures and no reporters," and yet you stayed. Why and how?
Yeah, it's funny. I saw that scene recounted on HBO's The Newsroom this past season. It's amazing to...
I wasn't going to make references to The Newsroom, but here we are in the fiction, but go ahead.
Yeah, I was watching it, and suddenly for a few minutes I saw myself being played on screen. So I went to one of the first meetings and the planning meetings before Occupy Wall Street began, and the first thing they asked was, you know, "Are there any reporters here?" And so my first experience with Occupy was a half-hour debate about whether I could stay, and they ended up letting me. And it was a kind of sign of how so much of this was starting from scratch. You know, nobody was really sure what they had come together for. They were inspired by this idea that a magazine had called for. Adbusters had a poster and an email blast that said, "Occupy Wall Street, September 17th, bring tent. What is our one demand?" But they had come together in these meetings without a whole lot in common and without knowing a whole lot of how they would go about doing this. And I certainly encountered that, in my first, when I first showed up.
Did you feel like these were kindred spirits? I mean, this is not totally objective what you're doing here, but did you feel like they were kindred spirits? Do you feel like these are people you had no idea what planet they were from? I mean, on that scale, where did you fall?
Well, I was excited by what was going on. I'm somebody who's been covering movements for a number of years. You know, my first job was in 2001 covering the protests in Washington, D.C., about the Afghanistan war. So this is something that I've been doing for a long time. And it was really, there was something different going on in this meeting. There was this kind of unsettledness and this kind of sense of starting from scratch, but there was also an energy that was really, really different and really exciting. Actually, at the same time, I was covering another group planning to occupy Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., and that was an older group, and they were better organized, and they had funds raised, and they, you know, had a lot of experience coming in, but the folks getting ready for Occupy Wall Street had this energy that was really unique and really exciting.
A little scruffy, but certainly very impassioned at the same time.
Yeah.
Nathan Schneider is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. We'll come back and talk more with Nathan about his experiences with Occupy Wall Street and what he saw going on inside of it. And you can join us as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Nathan and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Nathan Schneider. He is the author of a number of pieces as Occupy Wall Street happened for Harper's, The Nation, The New York Times, and other publications. Pulled it all together for a book called Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what happened during Occupy Wall Street and what has happened since then. What is the legacy of Occupy Wall Street? Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address, jx@jeffnet.org. There's the quote in here, you had to be there. And I get the sense that this is truer of Occupy Wall Street than just about anything else you've run across, Nathan.
Yeah, you know, and what I was trying to do with the book was to convey some of that experience, some of what a lot of people got from being there. And I used the word in the subtitle, apocalypse. You know, and that in the Greek original means unveiling or revelation. And I think so many people through the movement across this country experienced a kind of apocalypse or unveiling about the depth of inequality and injustice in our society that they hadn't maybe quite realized before, and also about the possibility of doing something about it and organizing and building power from the ground up.
This is a real proximity thing, though, too, wasn't it? Because I really get the sense that if you were right there in the middle of it, you really, really were, you got it. You really understood why people were out there. But it seems like as the distance grew, particularly as you get across the country, as we are here in the state of Jefferson, there was this sense of, like, what is it they want? What are they doing? And people certainly got the basic idea, you know, you're fighting against the people in power with money. But beyond that, did you get a real sense of from some people you talked to who weren't very close to it physically?
Yeah, well, I think there was a lot of, you know, there was so much going on in the movement, and people who were participating in it were kind of trying to understand as they were participating what was going on and what was so attractive about it. You know, it's a reminder that sometimes movements grow not so much because of rational calculation, but because there's something about them that's magnetic and exciting. At the same time, though, I think there was a lot that was very clear about this movement, and maybe sometimes got tangled up in the way it was presented. But I think there were very, you know, the idea of having an encampment at Wall Street, that place where the banks got bailed out after the financial crisis, the place that, you know, the government had put its priority, the place that was, you know, symbolizes the institutions that seem to have bought off our political system. I mean, these were messages that occupiers were making very clearly from day one. You know, that we live, that our government is bought and sold by corporate interests, and that something has to be done to change this, and that to do that, they have to build power from the ground up. You have to begin with community experience. You have to begin with creating another kind of space. You can't just, you know, elect another politician into the system, because the system is, you know, can't accept that. It can't tolerate that. You can't get someone into office without that kind of sponsorship.
So you can't work for change within the system. It really has to be done from without.
Well, there are gray areas and gradations, but the choice I think this movement made, you know, less like the Tea Party, which made a choice to really embrace elected officials, and in the process embrace corporate funding and funding from the very wealthiest Americans. It was more like a choice that churches make in the right in this country, you know, where the pastors don't necessarily become elected officials. They don't directly have their influence by becoming, you know, by entering the political system. They have their influence by building community from the ground up and building power and, you know, working on a local level and helping people support each other and simply live better. And I think that was more the model that Occupy was interested in pursuing as far as building power.
We have an email here from Pat, no location given. Pat writes, it was a good idea. Unfortunately, until banks, hedge funds, and private equity funds start paying taxes like it was income instead of capital investments, the economy is still screwed. Back in the 50s and 60s, when the top tax rates were 60% plus, the rich still made plenty of money, and there was money for government to function. Now, with the bankers, financiers, and businesses buying politicians, i.e. free speech election fund donations, the tax funds aren't available for the programs that Congress has mandated. Not to say anything about the unfunded mandates where Congress has passed laws and expects the state and local governments to fund. The 99% are still getting stuffed. The 1% have all the money and power and the ability to keep it that way. Well, somewhat pessimistic, I would say. Pat, thinking that things are pretty much as they were before.
Yeah, and I think there's a real truth to that. I mean, I think it can't be understated the extent to which Occupy was successful in rhetorical terms. It was successful as a kind of performance. In many ways, it shaped the discourse. Certainly, nationally, in the re-election campaign for Barack Obama, you saw this in the way that Obama was constantly painting Mitt Romney as a one-percenter poster child. And we've seen it really, really clearly here in New York with the recent mayoral primary, where Bill de Blasio just swept to a surprise victory by basically reading from the Occupy playbook and rhetoric. But it still remains for the kind of grassroots political power to push and to support, back up that rhetoric with real momentum. And there are people all over the country working in all kinds of different campaigns around environmental issues, around labor issues, around police brutality issues, things all kind of connected under this Occupy umbrella. But you know, it remains to be seen for them to unite again in a way that will enable them to really push for change.
Let us take a phone call. Here is Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nathan Schneider, the author of Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse.
Hiya. Thank you so much for the focus on this important issue. I'd like to chat just a little bit about the legacy of Occupy Wall Street and also hopefully the future. Here in Eugene, there are folks who have a regular weekly program, and Nathan, I think you were on that recently, Occupy Radio. And also there's a group that has Occupy Medical on Sunday. They help provide services to low-income people who need medical help. And I believe that there's also a media group that is maybe having discussions. I think they have a protest against the Bank of America every Friday, and I think that they also have a regular group of people getting together to discuss issues and stuff. I think that happens on Fridays. I'm wondering, Nathan, if you can talk a little bit about what's happening nationwide with remnants of Occupy. And also, I guess I disagree a little bit about electoral stuff. I really hope that all of us earthlings really start organizing on the local level and consider really finding common values that most of us agree with and literally running people for city council and county commissioner offices, city, school boards, all that kind of thing, and do it as soon as possible. We should take advantage of these primary elections and really start putting forth candidates to counter the Republican and Democrat monopoly that is happening with corporate, our tax money and all that stuff. Anyway, if you could talk a little bit about what is happening elsewhere and also any more comments just about us following the electoral route. And once again, thank you.
All right, Skeeter, thank you for the call.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you raise a lot of really great points, and the kinds of examples you give of ways in which people who are involved in the Occupy movement are continuing that work in particular ways where they see need in their community is happening all over the place. And I mentioned environmental struggles. There are people who are working on campaigns against fracking and the Keystone Pipeline, for instance, on labor issues, the low-wage worker struggles around fast food workers and Walmart. A lot of those are driven by folks who came out of Occupy. The Moral Mondays campaigns campaign in North Carolina has been really exciting, uptick led in many cases by faith leaders, and something like that is actually starting to brew here in New York City. So there are a lot of different things going on, and I think I don't mean to say that that you exclude electoral races, especially at the local level. I think you're right that there's a lot more opportunity to have a real kind of genuine voice heard. I think it's just a matter of reframing your approach to politics and to stop defining politics solely in terms of, electoral races and elected officials. And one of the things that Occupy apocalypse really meant for a lot of people was a kind of broadening of what politics is, rather than just being the choices that are offered to us by the particular leading parties. Politics becomes a kind of broader discourse among our communities of what our needs are and how we can fight and struggle to meet those needs. And if one of those tactics is electing people to electoral office, that's great, but just not putting that as the sole domain of political activity.
Where the choices tend to be binary still anyway, in a world of exploding choices. I mean, you don't just have to buy Wonder Bread anymore. How many different brands do you have? We're still stuck on chocolate, vanilla, A, B, Democrat, Republican.
Yeah, it's just astonishing. And we've been seeing this shutdown fiasco going on in the last few weeks. In the middle of 2011, just before Occupy Wall Street, there was another big round of debates about the debt ceiling and all these kind of made-up terms and made-up crises that are happening in Washington. And they dominate the news cycle, and they make us think that this is the crisis of our moment, when we all know also in the back of our heads that this is a crisis created by these politicians. And it kind of trumps and runs over the real crises that are facing our society, the incredible extent of poverty and homelessness in the society, of unemployment. We imprison more people than any country in the entire world. We spend more on the military than the whole rest of the world combined. These are crises, yet they're not presented as such by these politicians for particular reasons, because of their backers and their interests.
Nathan Schneider is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He was a participant and a reporter at Occupy Wall Street. He wrote the book Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Occupy Wall Street and the various offshoot movements and their legacies. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. Tawasi in Glenwood, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I just wanted to hear the author talk about his experience with the militarization of the police. You know, here in the Eugene Springfield area, we see just what look like stormtroopers, and they have a rapid response team that the, you know, local business association has called for that just like swoop down and arrest people. So I just wanted to hear what it was like from your viewpoint that, I don't even know what to call it, thuggishness of law enforcement.
All right, we'll take it from there. Thanks, Tawasi. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for your question. It was really astonishing what people were up against, and it was very different in different encampments around the country, obviously. But in New York, we were just so shocked by what was going on. I remember at one point on May Day in 2012, I was walking through the big main permitted May Day march, you know, organized by the unions, no civil disobedience, nothing going on. And I was walking with a nun in her 80s, you know, and she'd been protesting her whole life, and she just looked up at the line of, you know, maybe four or five helicopters in the sky, the thousands of police officers lining the entire march, the barricades surrounding it, preventing anybody from getting in or out. And she just kept asking, how did this happen? What has happened here? You know, and this is a legacy of the war on terror and the war on drugs and the way in which local law enforcement agencies have been getting tremendous funding for militarizing their forces, and it means that if you have these toys, you're going to use them. We're equipping these people, these agencies, to do much more than policing, and it was very scary to see that play out every day at Occupy Wall Street, where the answer to this peaceful protest was overwhelming force. It was just baffling.
We have a call here from Nicole in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nathan Schneider. His book is Thank You, Anarchy.
Hi, Nathan. Thanks for speaking and having me on. Here in Eugene, there has been a really strong community of homeless people who have participated in the Occupy movement. And presently, there's even a type of protest to apply their rights to sleep within the community and to be able to sleep out on the streets to be homeless, basically. So I'm wondering what role the homeless played in Occupy Wall Street in New York, and what role you think that they can play in the future, especially when the mainstream views the homeless community as people who are perhaps lazy or irresponsible. And so, you know, it's always that fight against the media, isn't it? You know, where we're trying to really represent ourselves correctly. What role did the homeless play at Occupy Wall Street, if any, and what role do you think that they can play in future movements?
All right. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you so much for your question. The homeless community in New York and the people who came from other places played a tremendous role in Occupy Wall Street, and it was, I think it was a humbling role because you know, so many people who were not homeless or you know, didn't need to be were involved in the movement, and in trying to work with people in the homeless community, there was, you know, all these real deep challenges, deep contradictions of American society arose in the encampment itself, and people really wrestled with, you know, how to put this crisis at the forefront. New York City has record levels of homelessness right now, especially among women and children. Yet shelters are being shut down, funding is being cut. It's astonishing. We actually have something like three times as many empty units of residential units in the city than we do homeless people. It seems like we shouldn't have any homelessness. Yet the way our economic system is structured, we have tremendous homelessness. And I think on the one hand, Occupy did a lot to put those issues on the map, to also be a forum through which homeless people could have a voice and could speak up. But I think the crisis really remains. And there are groups in New York right now who are trying to rethink how they do, for instance, housing activism in a way that's not just about protecting people who already have homes, but it's about reclaiming land and real estate for community control, so that buildings and spaces can be held under community land trusts and can be made available to people who really do need housing, as opposed to just those who happen to be able to pay for it.
Nathan, how did the decentralization of Occupy Wall Street evolve? I mean, somebody still had to decide, I guess, that they were going to not make decisions the usual way, right? And not have a real central focus, central face, et cetera?
Yeah, well, I mean, in some ways, the way that Occupy has operated in terms of governance and some of its structures is, shouldn't be really surprising to us. Actually, in the course of the early weeks of the movement, I spent a lot of time talking to a columnist at this website I had at wagingnonviolence.org, Mary Elizabeth King, who was a leader in SNCC and the civil rights movement. And she kept reminding me, like, this is pretty much how we were operating too. Hindsight isn't always 20/20, and we tend to romanticize the past. But a lot of past movements have had this kind of decentralized structure, and especially in the movements of 2011 in Egypt and Tunisia, this kind of way of operating from Anonymous to the Indignados in Spain was just, again, in the air, and it was part of a broader movement and orientation.
Much more to talk about with Nathan Schneider. He's the author of Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. We'll talk more about Occupy Wall Street and its various offshoots and the legacies they left behind that may still continue through society today. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Nathan and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Nathan Schneider, who took part in and covered the Occupy Wall Street movement at its heart in New York City and wrote a book about it called Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. You can join us to talk about your impressions of Occupy Wall Street and all the various other versions of it that cropped up around the country and what they achieved ultimately. 800-838-3760 is the phone number that works for all of our listening area. For Jackson and Josephine counties, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about anarchy. Thank You, Anarchy, the title of the book. You use the term small A anarchy inside it. What is that as opposed to big A anarchy?
Well, that's a term especially used by David Graeber, who is one of the kind of initiating intellectual voices of the movement. But I think small anarchy can be described as this kind of overlapping consensus that formed within the movement. It brought together people from a lot of different political positions, from people in socialist groups to people who are not really politically affiliated to even people who consider themselves libertarians or even on the political right. And this kind of way of operating formed in which, there wouldn't be a certain kind of hierarchical leadership structure, that anarchist values, even if a full kind of anarchist view of the universe didn't take hold, anarchist values were a way of operating and a way of working together among all of these very different groups.
Let us take some more calls. Dennis and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nathan Schneider.
Hi. I want to ask your guest there a question. Is he for capitalism? Is he into capitalism, or is he into socialism, or none of the above? I just kind of, I'm confused about what he's all about.
Well, there's what I'm all about, and there's what the movement's all about, and places they operate. I'm one person who was, in different ways involved. I think there is a way in which this movement was fundamentally an anti-capitalist movement. It, in the sense that it wanted to put human needs before the profit motive, before the needs of those who are trying to make a profit.
Okay, so you wrote this book. Are you trying to make any money off this book?
I'm trying to make a living like anybody else.
Okay, well, I mean, so you're basically, I'm not picking on you. I'm just saying that you're basically just like the rest of us. You're a self-employed, it sounds like, a self-employed capitalist who's out promoting a book and trying to make some money. And I assume, since the way you talk here, that your goal is to take this money and find some buildings that you could rent and buy and help homeless people have a place to live, because, you know, that would be the only honestly intellectual thing for you to do.
Is there a larger point you're trying to make here, Dennis?
Well, my point is that I am kind of wore out, you know. I've been watching this kind of stuff go on for, the hippie movement, all these movements over and over. We got the idiots in the Congress that are trying to destroy our country and the world economy. I mean, I'm just a regular old guy out here, you know, and I'm definitely part of the so-called 1%, but I get tired of...
Well, you're part of the 1% or the 99%?
...who are trying to make money and at the same time putting down the system that they're trying to use to make the money in.
All right, when you said 1%, did you mean to say 1% or 99%?
I said I'm 1%.
You're part of the 1%, okay.
Sure, just like everybody else is, probably.
All right.
I want to point out how, I won't talk about how little money I'm making in the process of doing this work, but I think it's important to make a distinction here. I mean, there's a huge difference between people who are working for a living wage, people who are, involved in doing something in their community and, you know, are thereby able to gain the means to survive, and having an economic system which is entirely oriented toward ensuring the profit of a very, very small number of people, excess profit. And the capital in capitalism is not just like the money that people make in wages. It is the way in which our entire structure, the structure of our entire system, is designed solely for profit, solely for those who own the companies, who own the corporations, and who don't participate in them. The vision of many people involved in the Occupy movement is for a more democratic economy, for a participatory economics, where the people who are actually putting their work, their labor into a product, into the projects that they undertake, can share in the decision-making power and in the economic power that they develop. That's not the case in this society, and it's amazing the extent to which the gap between the wealthiest and the rest of us continues to grow. And I think the questions that this caller is raising are in some ways kind of false. He's lumping in together, making a living and, just being able to support yourself with capitalism. That's not really the case. There's a difference there.
Well, it's not like you have a choice either, because as I think about this, and certainly in the context of the earlier discussion about homeless people, there are some people who are homeless by choice, but it's not like you can completely drop out of the system, because if you want things like food and shelter, you generally still have to have money to pay for those things.
Oh, sure. And if you look at not to say this is a kind of system that we would want to advocate, but, when you look at even kind of decidedly non-capitalist societies around the world, they still have money. There are still means of exchange. It's just that the way in which the society as a whole understands itself and governs itself is not primarily for the benefit of the capitalist class, of the very wealthiest who happen to own the industry.
So essentially what you're talking about, what people who are talking about leveling things off a little more on income to close the gap a bit, is talking about taking the bottom and the top and pushing them a bit more toward the middle. And as I sit here, I wonder if perhaps the top-to-bottom disparity is also what causes the left-to-right disparity, that we can't seem to see any middle ground politically either.
Well, there is middle ground, and I think that middle ground often gets obscured. And I'll give you an example. One thing that really... For instance, Democrats and Republicans, and also radicals on either end of the spectrum, really can unite upon, if you ask them about it, is worker-owned cooperatives. Republicans tend to support legislature for worker-owned cooperatives in this country. This is an incredibly powerful tool by which we can democratize the economy, where businesses can be owned by the people who participate in them and governed by them. These kinds of organizations have been effective and successful. And they operate in a very different way But it's not something that is really encouraged and talked about very much in our society, and it could be. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, people in Occupy were really excited to talk about and share with each other, these possibilities that are kind of off the political map, but which hold the hope for real transformative change, not just taking money from one side and giving it to the other, but really renewing our system spiritually as well as economically, helping us relate to each other in more democratic ways.
Nathan Schneider's our guest. His book is Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. And here's a call from Don in Ashland. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. Yeah, that last caller actually highlighted my point very well, which is that Occupy never captured the hearts of the American people, the hearts and the emotions. Like so many well-intentioned efforts for change, there is a tendency to think that ideas, concepts, facts are what motivates people. And the rhetoric is not going to get to the emotional questions that people really make their decisions based on. And I hear this in almost any kind of, as I say, well-intentioned movements, is that concepts are only a very small part of the process of how people make decisions.
All right. So thanks for that, Don. Appreciate it. Your thoughts, Nathan?
Yeah, I actually think that's a really wonderful point, though I would question the, you know, the premise that that Occupy didn't capture people's minds. I mean, within weeks, polls were showing that the majority of Americans supported what the Occupy movement was doing. This was astonishing for, you know, such a radical social movement so quickly. And I hope that what I capture in the book is actually precisely that that message that the last caller pointed to, which is that this movement wasn't just about the demand or the idea or the policy proposal. It was about an experience, and what drew people in was the glimpse of what another world could look like, a world that was more inspiring, more creative, more encouraging of the best in us as human beings than the society that we're in now. That's what really drew people in, much more than the just kind of like slogans and ambitions for policy change.
I find myself racking my brains to think about anybody who could be called an Occupy Wall Street leader. And even to this date, I can't think of anybody who really would emerge as the face of Occupy Wall Street. Whereas what is often viewed as the counterpart, although obviously a very different organization with very different strategies and not even that well organized itself, the Tea Party movement. But you've got faces there. You've got, see, and I guess what I'm getting to is that I think based on what our caller just talked about was that movements, or at least the people who perceive movements, need to see leaders at the head of them, need to have names and faces to attach to these, even if in the case of the Tea Party, it's somebody they can't stand, and that's Barack Obama. And so Occupy Wall Street, do you think it hurt itself by not going that route, or did it stay true to itself because it didn't?
Well, I think it kind of remains to be seen. I think in the moment that it was in, it was just the right thing to do. It was what people were feeling. It was what people all around the world were feeling. You know, remember in Tahrir Square when Mohammed el-Baradei, this internationally renowned Egyptian leader, shows up at the occupation at Tahrir and kind of offers himself as a figurehead for the movement. They all just say, "No, thank you. We don't need you." You know, that was yet another instance where these movements were trying to establish a real democracy. They were trying to establish a kind of real sense that the people are in charge, and this was reflected in you know, that the person of the year for Time magazine that year was the protester. So I'm not sure that it's true that Occupy was really hurt by not choosing a particular individual, because the images coming from the movement were still very strong. And we have to remember, in the history of social movements, we look back at them as if, for instance, Martin Luther King just came down from the sky, produced the civil rights movement, and then departed, when in fact this was a movement that was hugely complex with many different players and many different leaders on different levels. And King was somebody who, in our looking back historically and as the movement evolved, came forward as a certain kind of leader. You know, but I think maybe over time, as the issues around Occupy evolve and as these struggles evolve, leaders like that will emerge, and they already have. I mean, you can point to someone like Elizabeth Warren as somebody who has come through very much on the heels of the rhetoric of the Occupy movement and has become a major leader in Congress, pushing for bank reform, pushing for so many of the things that Occupy has called for.
So she actually uses some of the rhetoric of the Occupy movement or some of the goals of the Occupy movement, even though not necessarily identifying herself as a member of the Occupy movement.
Yeah, and she really couldn't. You know, the way this movement is structured is resolutely not to represent itself through electoral means. It's trying to build power in other ways. And if that helps, if that kind of trickles up, so to speak, you know, it's trickle-up politics. If that ends up affecting positively what's happening in the halls of government, then that's great, and that's part of what it's meant to do. But part of the power of the movement and its legitimacy in the eyes of the people who really care about it is to be non-aligned, to not become a political party, but to operate in a different kind of way.
You write in the book of one apotheosis above all the others. What was that?
Well, that was just a moment. That was a moment when there was supposed to be a cleaning of the park, and this was in October. And it really was, everybody knew, a veiled attempt to evict the park. This was at the moment I referred to a little while ago where more than half the country was behind the movement in polls, and all these organizations were trying to figure out how to take part, unions, Democratic Party leaders, all sorts of people were trying to figure out how they could pitch in. And that morning at 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning, before the sun rose, thousands and thousands of people filled the park and prevented that eviction from happening. And that was a moment of incredible unity and power and momentum that a month later collapsed when a surprise attack from the NYPD evicted the park.
Nathan, we're almost out of time. We do find ourselves flopping back and forth between past and present tense. Is there a future tense for Occupy Wall Street, do you think?
Well, in some way, it may not be called Occupy, but there are a lot of people all over the country who are doing the kind of slow, quiet, untelevised organizing that for them was inspired by what they experienced in Occupy Wall Street. And they're doing it in all these different campaigns on many different issues. And I think it remains an open question of how they will unite again and how they will push forward as a united front. But I think on some level, in some way, that will happen.
We will keep watching. The book is called Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Nathan Schneider wrote it. Thank you so much, Nathan, for joining us today.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thank you to you and your callers.
All right, take care. The Ashland New Plays Festival will be one of our topics on Monday's Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock. Then we'll talk about inspecting illegal pot grows in California for environmental violations. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of Our Road to Hatred, How We Raise Our Bullies. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you again soon. Have a great weekend.